It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says yesterday's Supreme Court decision to eliminate limits on total campaign donations could be a sign of things to come for campaign finance laws here in Wisconsin.
First, Congress has designated April as National Distracted Driving Awareness Month. Even though most people know it's dangerous, people continue to eat meals, put on makeup, send text messages while they're driving.
The Centers for Disease Control estimates that every day 9 people die and over 1,000 are injured in car accidents caused by distracted driving. Now the Federal Transportation Secretary is launching a new campaign. It's called You Drive, You Text, You Pay.
Randy Romanski is with us. He's the Safety Program's Chief at the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Randy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having us on.
Well, what kinds of behaviors at the wheel fall under the term distracted driving?
Well, you indicated them in the front end. I mean, distracted driving takes many forms, and unfortunately, people see it every day when they're driving to work or home or to the grocery store. It can be somebody texting. It can be somebody combing their hair, eating a meal, putting on makeup. I've seen people shaving with an electric razor. All of those things and others do what is an unfortunate and unnecessary thing. It's to take people's attention away from what they're supposed to be doing, which is driving the vehicle they're in. And it causes distraction to them. It causes a safety hazard to themselves, their passengers, and anybody else on the road.
Now, as I understand it, in Wisconsin, it is legal to talk on your cell phone while you're driving. Is that considered distracting?
There actually is a state law. Last year, the legislature did add a section to our inattentive driving statute that prohibits cell phone usage for drivers with probationary licenses unless the device is used to report an emergency. What that means is it's primarily targeting teenagers, but it also affects anybody else who might have a probationary license. And so while Wisconsin does permit cell phone usage for drivers with operating licenses, it is another one of those things that can be a distraction to somebody who's on the road, and that includes whether you're hands-free or handheld. I mean, it's another thing that even though you think you're focusing on the road because you're just talking into the phone, your brain is actually also focusing on the conversation you're having with the person on the cell phone. So it's another type of distraction, and I think that's one of the reasons why the legislature did add this section into the statutes about probationary licenses.
Now, there's been a fair bit of science on how able we are to multitask as we're driving. And as I understand it, some of the things that I saw is that we think we are pretty good at eating a meal or texting or talking while we're driving. But in reality, our skills break down a lot quicker than we think they do.
I think you make a very good point. A recent National Safety Council poll found that 80% of drivers falsely believe that a hands-free device is safer than a handheld device, and now there are dozens of studies that show those kinds of devices are unsafe because the brain remains distracted by, in this particular case, we're talking about cell phones, but you know there are any number of things that people are doing behind the wheel that causes a lapse in attention to traffic or road conditions, and it does become a grave concern to safety.
Now, one thing most people have to do when they're driving is ride with another person in the car. You have a conversation while you're driving. How is that different than the kinds of things that we're talking about under the auspices of distracted driving?
Well, it is a qualifying point. You know, you would think, just in being with some of the other things we've talked about, there is a difference between applying makeup while looking in a rearview mirror or combing your hair while looking in a rearview mirror versus looking straight ahead, having a conversation with a passenger in the vehicle next to you. So there are some levels of concern. One of the things that I would point out is that the legislature has created laws regarding graduated driving licenses. That does restrict the number of passengers that can be in a vehicle, because what data has shown is that the more passengers you get into a vehicle, especially with novice drivers, especially with younger drivers, it creates a safety hazard, and that's what's led to some of the restrictions on the number of passengers in a vehicle.
Now, there's been a lot of attention lately, your campaign or this campaign about you text or you drive, you text, you pay, that national campaign. A lot of people talking about this to raise awareness, and yet it still happens. It's still commonplace. There are fatalities. There are something like 9 a day related to distracted driving. Why is it still so widespread?
That's a really great question. I wish I knew the answer why people still continue to do some of these things behind the wheel, but you're right. More than 3,300 people were killed in crashes involving distracted drivers in 2012, and approximately another 421,000 people were injured. That's really staggering, staggering data, and shows how unsafe these practices can be. There are a lot of, I guess the best thing to do is to focus on the positive steps people can take to prevent distractions from whether it's cell phone use, texting, anything else. I mean, the simple answer for some of these things is just don't do them. So don't eat a hamburger when you're behind the wheel driving 55 miles an hour down the highway, or anywhere for that matter. But some simple things, because people feel, I think people feel connected to technology like never before, so there's a lot of attention focused on cell phone and texting. There are some simple steps that people can take to address that. Number one is turn off the phone or switch it to a silent mode when they're behind the wheel. Actually use a voicemail to tell callers that you're driving and you will return the call as soon as possible. That's something that the Department of Transportation has encouraged, and I think some people do that. If you absolutely need to use a cell phone or to take a call or to text, pull over to a safe area, pull into a parking lot, get off the roadway, and take care of it that way when you're not, when your vehicle's not moving. Ask a passenger to make a call for you. And there are now mobile apps that are out there that can actually prevent texting while driving. So there's a variety of options that people can use to prevent or to divert their potential interest in doing some of those things.
So those are lots of personal choice behaviors that people can choose to do when they're driving. But what about the state of Wisconsin? What's Wisconsin doing to stop distracted driving?
Well, you mentioned earlier there is the national You Drive, You Text, You Pay, which is a new national distracted driving enforcement campaign. Wisconsin does also have its own campaign to try to prevent distracted driving and raise awareness of how severe this issue is and how big of a risk it can cause, and in effect it's entitled Anywhere But There, and actually it involves the skills and talents of a Wisconsin native, Rhinelander area native, Austin Wershke, who is the reigning 2-time LG U.S. National Texting Champion. And basically, we've used his skills in texting extremely fast, which he demonstrates in the commercial that's been designed, that he texts pretty much wherever he goes, including some kind of unusual circumstances, but he never texts while he's driving. And that's something that he actually told us about before we developed the campaign, because it's too dangerous. And so that's one of the campaigns that the state of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin DOT, put together with a Wisconsin native last year. We are continuing that this year. The Department of Transportation is doing a public information campaign, again, to raise awareness about the dangers of texting while driving and to try and discourage people from doing that.
So what if you're a citizen, you're out on the road, you see someone behaving in a way that's distractive, it looks unsafe to you? I recently saw a woman texting with both hands while her car kept moving down the road. Besides feeling outraged, is there anything we can do?
Well, there are opportunities available to the citizens. The statute under which the legislature has created the prohibition on texting, and what I'll say is as of February of this year, 42 states, Washington, D.C., and several territories do have a ban in place for texting for drivers. So this is kind of it's becoming a more universal law in the United States. So if somebody sees that happening, there is an opportunity, and you feel that person is endangering themselves or others, people can call 911 because of the potential danger on the roadway. So, for instance, the statute in which the state of Wisconsin prohibition on texting while driving is also it also prohibits inattentive driving, and the law specifically states no person while driving a motor vehicle shall be so engaged or occupied as to interfere with the safe driving of such a vehicle. So while there is a specific prohibition about texting while driving, there is a more broad definition of inattentive driving, where if somebody is engaged in something that is jeopardizing the safety of themselves or others on the roadway, there is a law against that as well.
Randy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I really appreciate the opportunity, and we are trying to drive our fatalities in Wisconsin towards zero, and we hope that people are safe and use some of these tips to prevent distraction behind the wheel.
We've been talking to Randy Romanski, Safety Programs Chief at the Wisconsin Department of Transportation.
Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a pillar of campaign finance law. The court ended restrictions on the total amount of money any donor can give to candidates during an election cycle.
It was the case of Sean McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission. Writing the majority opinion, Chief Justice Roberts cited the protection of free speech and said that laws intended to prevent government corruption should address bribery, not political speech, even if the laws may allow greater influence for the wealthy.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts about the decision. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Here with us today in the studio to help get an understanding of what this decision could mean, how it could affect Wisconsin, is Mike McCabe. He's Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What do you see as the impact of this ruling of the Supreme Court?
Well, this is a ruling that benefits about 1,200 people. There were 1,219 donors nationally who bumped up against this limit in the 2012 elections. So we're talking about in a country of over 300 million people, there were about 4 out of every million Americans who bumped up against this limit. One of them was Sean McCutcheon, a very wealthy Alabama businessman. He felt the limit was cramping his style, and he wanted that limit removed, and the court obliged him. He sued and challenged the law. This was a federal case, was challenging federal campaign contribution limits, but it certainly has implications for state law as well.
So what this means is for a wealthy donor like that, they could go to a party and say, take the number of House of Representatives candidates, Senate candidates, presidential candidates, multiply it by the limit. Here's a check for that amount.
Yeah, there's still going to be limits on the amount you can give to any individual candidate,
right,
or any individual political committee. But one of the reasons why there's an aggregate limit, and at the federal level, the limit was $123,200. That's an amazing amount of money for most people to contemplate giving in political contributions. But there were 1,219 donors who bumped up against that limit. But the reason that aggregate limit is in there is to prevent people from being able to circumvent the limits to individual candidates. Now what's going to be able to happen is you're going to be able to give money to other candidates who can then in turn make contributions to candidates who really need the money. Or you can give it to another political committee or a party committee, and they will be able to steer money to candidates in really competitive races. So now somebody like Sean McCutcheon, instead of being able to give $2,600 to a particular congressional candidate, he'll be able to give $2,600 to that candidate, some more to some other candidates, in fact, any other candidate, other political committees, and then they could steer the money to a person who really needs that money. They would be getting Sean McCutcheon's money as well, and way more than $2,600. So one of the things that aggregate limits were supposed to do is prevent money laundering, the circumvention of the individual contribution limits. That aggregate limit, that protection is now gone because of the Supreme Court ruling.
A main argument from the plaintiff and in the majority opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts is, hey, the government should have a really light touch on regulating any form of political expression. There has to be some proven harm here, and we don't see it that way. We don't see a proven harm to letting people donate, in effect, as much as they want. Shouldn't the government have a light touch? Is it do we run into trouble when we regulate political expression?
Well, what the court did many years ago, it started in 1976, is they really radically redefined the meaning of free speech, and they reinterpreted the First Amendment. The First Amendment only has 45 words, and money is not one of those words. But in 1976, the court ruled that money equals speech. And the Citizens United decision in 2010 built on that concept. The McCutcheon decision further builds on that doctrine, the money is speech doctrine. Well, when money becomes speech, then effectively what the court has done is removed the R from free speech. They've turned that right into a privilege that has to be purchased at great expense. And now you have a situation where ultra-wealthy donors, one out of six American billionaires ran up against this limit. And they're now going to be able to go way beyond that limit and dole out even more money to candidates, have even more influence over those who serve in office, and that in turn will weaken the voices of ordinary citizens. The voter loses here, loses influence over their own elected representatives, and big money donors gain considerable influence thanks to this decision. And it's a ruling that affects 0.00003% of the American population.
Given that so few people can do this, is this really going to affect American politics that much?
Oh, it affects American politics in a huge way, but it's very few people who are now going to be able to have greater impact on the political process. And of course, all the other over 300 million Americans see their ability to have a voice and have influence in the process diminished because of the fact that now these 1,219 donors have an unlimited ability to steer money to various campaigns and circumvent the limits that were put in place to try to guard against corruption. What we have right now, effectively, is a new form of legal bribery that's growing up around us. And, you know, Wisconsin banned the practice of bribery back in 1897. And of course, we became a state in 1848. So for the first half century of statehood, bribing a public official was perfectly legal. It was finally outlawed in 1897. Now, because of these court rulings that started in 1976, what we basically have is the reemergence of a new form of legal bribery, and that corrupts the political process. It can corrupt our elected officials. Ultimately, the voters end up being the losers in this equation.
The court made the argument that it isn't bribery if there isn't a specific quid pro quo. I'm not saying I'm donating you, candidate X, money. You make this change to the law in exchange for that money.
That's what the court majority did argue, and of course, the vast majority of Americans just see that as phony logic. You know, in fact, just on Tuesday, we had 13 Wisconsin communities ask the question, do you believe that there's too much money in politics? And overwhelmingly, in Scott Walker's hometown of Wauwatosa, in Waukesha, in communities all across the state, Elkhorn, in every one of these 13 communities, super majorities of voters said, yes, there's too much money in politics, and they even support amending the Constitution to reverse these rulings and reverse the effects of Citizens United and now the McCutcheon decision.
What's this going to mean here in Wisconsin, this ruling?
Well, this was a federal case, and it challenged the federal aggregate campaign contribution limit, but there are states, including Wisconsin, that have their own versions of these limits at the state level. We do have an aggregate contribution limit in Wisconsin. Now you're going to see wealthy donors and these interests challenge those state laws as well. And they're going to use the McCutcheon decision as their justification for why these things should be thrown out. So our ability at the state level to protect against these, our campaign contribution limits being circumvented, money being steered and effectively laundered from one campaign committee to another, from one candidate to another, that is very much in jeopardy now at the state level.
Do you think these state laws will end up in the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, there's already a case that's been filed in federal court challenging Wisconsin's state limit. And now I think that the argument is going to be made. See, the United States Supreme Court said that these kinds of limits are unconstitutional. They should be struck down at the state level as well. So we're going to see these kinds of challenges, and I think that puts state politics in as great a jeopardy as federal elections.
We're talking to Mike McCabe. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, talking about the Supreme Court's decision yesterday to strike down limits on total aggregate campaign donations.
Yeah, we'd like to hear from you on this. What do you think of the ruling? Are you concerned that it could give wealthy donors a disproportionate voice in elections? Or does the ruling protect the First Amendment? And what do you see about the influence here on Wisconsin? Our number, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back with Mike McCabe, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. We're talking about the Supreme Court's decision yesterday to strike down limits on total campaign donations to federal candidates. The decision could lead to the end of Wisconsin state laws limiting contributions here.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. Supreme Court made a good decision in favor of free speech, or are you worried that this gives wealthy donors an outsized say in elections? Again, 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Peter on the line in Baraboo. Peter, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you so much. I'm a recently elected Sauk County supervisor as well as a member of the Baraboo School Board. I have seen what is happening in our state in terms of local elections, the kinds of money that are now filtering down from federal to state to local elections is one of the horrors of United Citizens United. It is probably one of the worst decisions the Supreme Court has made, and I will do everything in my power as an elected official to help overturn that. Thank you.
Peter, thanks for the call. Mike McCabe?
And not only is Citizens United something that dropped a bomb on the political landscape, but now the Supreme Court has really doubled down with the McCutcheon ruling. And we are seeing these big money influences from out of state trickling all the way down to the local level. In Polk County, we saw outside money coming in to try to influence county board races. In Iron County, we saw the Koch brothers group, Americans for Prosperity, jump into county board races there. And then a Kenosha school board race, again, Americans for Prosperity jumped in and tried to influence the elections there. So it's coming to a community near you soon, and we saw it in three instances here and at the local level. So not only have state elections been Washingtonized, but now it's really beginning to affect us at the community level.
We'll go now to Lynette with us in Milwaukee. Lynette, hi.
Yeah, hi. You know, I think one of the things that really upsets me is that the court has made decisions against average everyday people. So making it harder to sue on discrimination issues, either gender or race, if the person doesn't have the power to hire or fire, but, you know, has the power to basically run you off the job. And you have Congress refusing to extend unemployment. And even Glenn Grossman, you were saying in one of the news pieces, saying, oh, he wants to run because people are too dependent on welfare. And yet we're giving all of this access to people with money. I'm just surprised and perplexed as to why more average people aren't outraged or they just don't get it.
Mike?
Oh, I think average people are outraged. But the question is, how long will it take for the public consensus that is emerging? And it's really a tripartisan consensus. Democratic voters, Republican voters, and independent voters are alike are voting to move to amend the Constitution, saying there's too much money in politics and we need to do something about this. The question is, how long will it take for that public consensus to sink in with the public officials? There's a real disconnect right now between the public and the public officials. That's not healthy and it's not sustainable.
Before we go back to our callers, I've seen some people say, hey, there's a silver lining here with this new McCutcheon ruling as compared to Citizens United. They say Citizens United opened up a lot of donations that don't get disclosed, don't require always names to be put on who made the donation. These donations to parties, donations to candidates over, I think, $100 are disclosed. So even though there's more money, there's more transparency.
Well, you know, there's a huge dark cloud there, and they're trying to suggest that that's a tiny silver lining on a huge dark cloud. But, you know, the same argument was made when lawmakers here in Wisconsin said that they wanted to double the limits on campaign contributions. And they said that'll mean more money will be steered to the candidates, and that'll be disclosed, and less money will go to the interest groups. that spend money secretly. Well, we had a test of that theory in all those recall elections that we had in Wisconsin, because in those elections, there were no limits on contributions to candidates. You could give as much as you want to the candidates targeted for recall, and yet we still saw record spending by these shadowy outside interest groups. So it didn't stop or inhibit at all the money from flowing to those groups. This won't either. It'll give those wealthy donors just another channel to funnel their money, but they're also going to spend their money and send their money to these interest groups that sponsor their own advertising, just as they give the money to the candidates.
So if they could already donate all they wanted to these interest groups, does it matter that they have this new info? Does McCutcheon make that much difference? Is it going to add more to the aggregate sum of money in elections?
I think clearly Sean McCutcheon thought so. He wanted to be able to not only funnel money to interest groups, he wanted to give directly to elected officials. He wants them to know that the money's coming from him. And he felt inhibited in his ability to give money directly to candidates. So what Citizens United did is said that interest groups can spend as much as they want. You can't put any limit on what outside interest groups spend to influence elections. McCutcheon takes the next step and says, well, maybe we shouldn't limit what people give directly to the candidates. And they said, if you have unlimited interest group spending, that's not corrupting because it's not money going directly to the candidates. Now the court's turning around and saying increasing the limits on or abolishing limits on the money that goes directly to candidates, that's not corrupting either. It's really amazing that the court just keeps moving the ball and saying that there really isn't such a thing as money corrupting politicians. And, of course, the general public looks at that and sees it as really a preposterous notion.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Matt on the line in Green Bay. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. Great show. Thank God for public radio and public media. I wonder if the paid-for broadcast media has been doing backflips on this decision as well. We all rail against the system and scream, oh, my God, we can't have this going on. There's too much money in politics. Now we're going to throw more in. And we rail that why isn't the public more outraged? Well, they're not hearing about it from any other media source because the media is making a fortune on these campaigns.
Matt, thanks for the call. I mean, there's been a lot of media attention, Mike, but do you think that that the media isn't paying enough attention to these issues?
Well, clearly television in particular is a major beneficiary of all this campaign money, because if you look at where the money goes, the biggest single expense is television advertising. And the broadcast industry has also fought against sensible campaign finance regulation, and particularly the big television owners. And so, you look at America, we're the only major democracy on earth that doesn't have some form of free airtime for candidates to be able to communicate with voters without having to pay for all that airtime. That's why there's such a demand for political money. These interest groups and these candidates need the money because they need to buy television airtime.
So, Mike, when it comes down to it, do you think this money in politics and the expansion of the flow of money in politics changes the way our nation is governed, the way laws are passed?
Oh, absolutely. And on every issue, every day, you see Congress and you see the state legislature making decisions that benefit these big donors and the interest groups that supply all this cash. They are ceaselessly catering to these interests. You see it on issue after issue. And the public gets it. You know, the public, your average voter is not stupid. They can read the handwriting on the wall and they can see how that all this money corrupts the system, even if the Supreme Court pretends that they can't see it. And that's why you're seeing all this activism at the local level, bringing these votes up in communities all across Wisconsin and all across the country, where people are saying, you know, money's not speech. Corporations are not people. Elected offices are not commodities that are supposed to be sold on the open market. That this is a corrupt system, and I don't think we've seen conditions like this in our lifetimes. You have to go back to the late 1800s and the Gilded Age, the age of the robber barons, to see comparable conditions, comparable threats to democracy. And I think people get that. And that's why there's a growing movement to try to push back against this.
But as long as the U.S. Supreme Court disagrees with that movement, is anything going to change?
Well, you know, there's always been courts over the course of history that have issued rulings that aren't in keeping with public opinion. Of course, we had a Supreme Court that once said that people could be property. They gave their blessing to slavery. And of course, it took an amazing abolitionist movement over the course of decades to finally overturn that ruling and abolish slavery in this country. It's going to take a monumental effort in this case to deal with the scourge of money in politics and the threats to our democracy.
Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Mike McCabe, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. We've been talking about the Supreme Court's decision yesterday, striking down limits on total campaign donations. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Next week, Tuesday, marks the 20th anniversary of the death of the man our next guest calls the last rock star.
Kurt Cobain changed the world around him. He influenced the fashion world, his band gave birth to the grunge era, and his struggle with addiction and fame influenced the people who knew his story and beyond.
Charles R. Cross joins us now. He's the author of the new book, Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we said, next week, Tuesday, the 20th anniversary of Kurt Cobain's suicide. When you look back, what do you see as the most striking thing about his life and his influence?
Well, I think ultimately the reason we're talking about him 20 years after his death is those songs. The songs that he created with Nirvana, roughly 120 different titles or so, that ultimately is the reason that he matters. That music touched a generation. It has touched so many fans since Kurt even died. Nirvana sold 35 million albums, which is truly extraordinary numbers in terms of the rock world, especially given today in the digital download world. And not only that, those songs are great songs. They're important songs. And they often show up frequently at the very, very upper reaches of any critics list of some of the greatest songs ever made.
And some critics have even upgraded Nirvana from their original point of view. Rolling Stone is one.
Well, that's something I chronicle in this new book, and I found it almost kind of comical. When Nevermind first came out in 1991, Rolling Stone gave it 3 out of 5 stars. And since then, they have corrected that review, so to speak, without any notes. So if you go online on their website, you see that they are actually now giving that album 4 stars online. But that same 3-star album from 1991 was fairly recently by Rolling Stone's critics voted the 17th greatest album of all time. So clearly that, to some degree, kind of shows the rise in Kurt and Nirvana's reputation as these years go by. Usually bands fade as time goes by. With Nirvana, it's almost been the opposite. Their reputation has gone up.
Now, if you were one of those people touched by Nirvana and the music and the sentiments that they were singing about, you'll remember when Kurt Cobain died, when his death was announced and his suicide. Do you remember where you were, what your first thoughts were when you heard?
Well, I certainly do. I was one of the first people to even hear that a body had been discovered at Kurt's house, and I begin this book telling that tale of my life. I was editor of a magazine called The Rocket, which chronicled the Northwest music scene. We were the first magazine to ever put Kurt and Nirvana on the cover, and he'd even advertised in our magazine a number of times, and trying to look for drummers for the band as it was started out. So we were kind of the hometown paper, and I got a call from a radio station just like you guys, and they had gotten the tip before the police had even heard. An electrician had found a body at Kurt's house. They'd called the radio station, of all things, at the same time police were called. And the radio station called me and said, could it possibly be true? So I write in this book that at least for a brief period of time, I was one of only a few people who knew, as I call it, quote unquote, this horrible secret. And it was horrible. The fact that we lost this young man in his prime was just, it was the saddest day probably of my life so far, and certainly one of the most shocking in Seattle music history.
Kurt Cobain had a well-known problem with his own fame and the way he kind of processed it and dealt with it, and also the commodification of his music, of his art. And you can kind of hear that being played out in the songs that he sang, that Nirvana played. Let's listen to Nirvana's most famous song, Smells Like Teen Spirit.
To
And Charles, what do you hear in the lyrics there, listening back 20 years now?
Well, I certainly hear angst, and I hear depression, and I hear anger. What's interesting about that song nowadays is we sort of take it for granted that pop music covers those themes. But in the era before Nirvana and before Nevermind and Smells Like Teen Spirit, most of the hit pop songs were about girls and cars. You know, Nirvana kind of followed this awful era of hair metal bands, these heavy metal bands that did these awful ballads. And that was what was at the top of the charts. So this song not only was a powerful anthem, it also was something that kind of blew all that away. And that's another reason, frankly, that it's important.
And Kurt committed suicide. You talked about how you were one of the first people who found out. It was one of the saddest days of your life. And for lots of people, a lot of people heartbroken about that. He struggled with heroin addiction, among other things, problems with drugs. How was that suicide processed by the fans and those people in the addiction community?
Well, I also cite that in this book and kind of look at his suicide. It's one of the most famous suicides of modern times, and it was highly studied. Even myself, who wrote a 2001 biography of Kurt called Heavier Than Heaven, which tells the story of his life, I wasn't aware of how studied Kurt's suicide has been, because people are graduate students and they're becoming what they call suicidologists. And so there have been a couple of doctorate and dissertations done on Kurt Cobain's suicide. Plus, a lot of public health professionals wanted to look at this event because they wanted to see what they could learn from it and how we could essentially save lives of other people. What we found, ironically, is that Kurt's suicide, no matter how horrible it was and how tragic it was, the reporting of it and the fact that it was not glamorized, it was not romanticized at all, and of course the choice he took and how he took his own life was also pretty horrific. The suicide researchers think that the suicide rate went down in a number of places they studied in the immediate time after Kurt's death. So in an odd way, it did bring attention to suicide, and I think people got help. Sadly, that rate continues to go up in our society. It's an epidemic. If there's anything we can learn from his story, it's that if somebody is struggling, they need to reach out for help, that it's a normalization thing to go through these thoughts at times. But unfortunately, it's still one of the leading causes of death in our society.
Do we know with any certainty now why Kurt Cobain killed himself?
Well, being a biographer, I've had the chance to read through Kurt's journals and to sort of look at some of his inner life and to see some of the things that drove him and that he wrote about. I don't think we can ever definitively say, Kurt also suffered from some physical stomach ailments, and that was something I think that was with him forever. I think the ultimate answer is that if Kurt had actually gotten treatment for his depression and maybe his physical ailments, I think then his drug addiction, which was his attempt to kind of self-medicate those things, might have been more successful at fighting that, and maybe he would have had a greater chance. But remember, suicide was in his family. He had lost several other people in his family to suicide. There are even people that I cite in this book who believe that there may be a gene that predisposes someone to suicide. And if there is, Kurt Cobain certainly had that stacked against him.
And you could hear him again working out some of those issues, or at least expressing them in his songs. And as far as the struggle with drugs and what was going on inside his own head, Lithium is one of the songs that deals with that. Let's listen.
I'm so happy 'cause today found my friends in my head. I'm so ugly, that's okay, 'cause so are you. Book on me.
And Charles, what do you think of Lithium? What comes to mind?
I love Lithium. It's the song that actually people thought maybe would be the biggest song off of Nevermind before Smells Like Teen Spirit took off. But that song, as far as we know, Kurt never actually took Lithium, and he never actually was properly diagnosed or treated for depression, unfortunately. But I do completely agree with you that within his lyrics, he was working out some of that psychological pain that he had. Ultimately, though, that I also think is the reason that he had his greatest gift. He took that inner pain and he put it in these lyrics and in these songs. And that's why people can relate to it, because these are very human emotions. We all go through these kind of struggles. Yet he was able to take that pain and create art out of it. And to me, that's the reason that I admire Kurt as an artist and as a musician.
You call Kurt Cobain the last rock star. Why do you say that?
It's funny, of everything in my book, that has been the most controversial thing. And I've had numerous rock critics and radio hosts, you know, want to argue that point and say that Kanye West or, you know, Jay-Z, they deserve that mantle. But I don't think anybody that we've had in 20 years has had exactly that combination of charisma and what I was referring to here, the songwriting genius that Kurt had within those lyrics. That's why we matter. That's why he mattered. That's why we care about him. We haven't seen that in one star in the last 20 years. And with the technological changes that make, you know, the buying of music something that even the biggest star today will sell one-tenth of what Nirvana did in the year they were hot, I think the chances of us even having another star like that again are less likely than they've been for a while. I hope there is. I hope there's another great rock star, because as a fan of music, I want more voices like that. But at this point, Kurt is one of the last of the rock greats.
Now, we talked about how he had this incredible ambivalency about his fame, and he was worried about being authentic and worried about selling out. And I remember reading in his suicide, some of his writings prior to his suicide, worries about his daughter kind of becoming a phony and selling out herself, and it made him sad. So who knows if he'd be singing now? Who knows if he'd be in the music biz if he were still alive? But what do you think we've been missing out, you know, these past 20 years without Kurt Cobain?
Well, we certainly missed all the music that he created. Kurt also was a very humorous guy and a very smart guy, and he used his mantle, his position at the top of rock, to speak out about a number of social issues. There has never been a rock star that was as strong a feminist as Kurt Cobain, or one that spoke out in favor of gay rights more than him. In fact, he did something truly extraordinary. Not only did he speak out about those issues, which many other rock stars still do and have done, he actually wrote liner notes that said, if you are a bigot and you're a homophobe, do not buy my albums. No rock star before or since has ever tried to self-select their audience and to say, don't even buy my music or come to my shows if you don't agree with my political beliefs. Kurt, of course, couldn't self-select his audience. He became a huge star nonetheless, and he had all kinds of people in his crowds. But the very fact that he did that is also something truly extraordinary about him.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Charles R. Cross, the author of Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain.
Coming up, our next guest makes the case for abolishing the United States Air Force. We'll find out why after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.